This is a podcast from Shooting People. Hello, this is Andy Conway and welcome to another Shooting Screenwriters podcast. This month we have an extra special treat for you due to the visit of Sid Field, who is in London to give his Foundations of Screenwriting seminar, courtesy of Movieskope magazine and the Screenwriters Store.
We've got so much to talk about, and it's—I almost do not need to give you an introduction, because anyone, any writer who begins to tackle screenwriting or think of themselves as a screenwriter, your book or your name is the first one they will come across when they go on that journey. Because of your book, Screenplay, which came out quite a while ago.
Yeah, the original came out in 1980. Then it sold so well, so fast, that they reissued it in 1982. And then they had me update it in 1984. And then it was cool until, I think, early 90s for the third edition that came out. And then I've just revised the entire book just a year ago. And I look at it as a totally new book, Screenplay. But what I saw was very interesting. When I went to rewrite the original book, I saw that you can't fix something that ain't broke. So I didn't know exactly what to do except to bring everything up to date and expand upon the basic principles and precepts which are set forth in Screenplay. Because a material is like rock-solid foundation that everybody needs to know when they set out to write a screenplay, and it's a real guide to the journey of screenwriting.
The interesting thing about the book when it arrived was no one had really said there is a structure to screenwriting, to the writing of a movie script. And you were, I believe, the first to actually map that out and produce a paradigm. And that paradigm has changed over the years, hasn't it? You've kind of added bits here and there since the original version.
Well, what I found was I didn't know what I was doing, of course, when I wrote about the paradigm. But I knew that in my background, I started out as making documentaries, as an English major in the university, then as a documentary filmmaker, starting out as a gopher to a researcher to assistant producer to associate producer to writer producer to writer director producer and so on. And one of my jobs was to work on a series called Hollywood and the Stars. And Hollywood and the Stars was dedicated and focused on a half-hour series on NBC, focusing on great actors, great directors, great moments in films, great love stories, great everything. Hollywood and the Stars. And it was my job to pull clips.
Not great screenwriters, then.
Nothing about screenwriters, no. Nothing. But I was locked in this editing room with no windows, and I had a stack of 15 or 20 movies that I was looking for to pull clips from. And I began to understand that if you look for a great lover scene, you start with a kiss and then work backward to see where it came from. And I think over the years, as I began teaching screenwriting, after writing screenplays, that always remained with me. So when I began reading screenplays at Cinemobile back in the early 70s, I had started at Wolper in the 60s, and then I had left to become a freelance screenwriter late 60s to 70s, almost 7 years, I think. And then where I wrote 9 screenplays. I had no clue what I was doing. I know that the first thing I had was an experience with Sam Peckinpah. And I was started out as an actor at Berkeley, and then worked with Jean Renoir and as a classical actor at Berkeley back in the 60s. And then I wanted to become... to go to grad school. I didn't like it. I dropped out after 8 weeks, and Renoir grabbed me and told me that the future is film. So he wrote me this letter in pencil, which I can't find to this day, unfortunately, and he wrote it to UCLA, and he said, please admit Sid Field to the graduate school at UCLA Film School. So I said, okay, and I went down, and my filmmaking buddies were guys by the name, one was named Jim Morrison and the other was named Ray Manzarek. Mm-hmm. And they had a rock band, a garage band at that time, called The Doors.
Little known.
A little known, exactly. And we all left after a year. They went on to their, you know, history. I went on to Wolper. And the thing that really influenced me the most was sitting in that room looking at all these great movies, these great performances, these great stories, these great film noirs of Hollywood that I never knew about. And somehow I think that was retained by me so that when I went to work at Cinemobile, reading all these screenplays, I began to see a certain pattern. And after I was at Cinemobile reading in the story department for 2 years, I read more than 2,000 screenplays, found 40 to submit to our partners, and I was asking myself the question, why were those 40 screenplays better than the other 1960? So I had no answers at that point, but I was invited to teach a screenwriting class at a place called Sherwood Oaks Experimental College. Sherwood Oaks at the time was a professional school taught by professionals. So Robert Redford came in and taught a class on acting for the camera. Paul Newman came in and taught a class on just acting in general. Lucille Ball came in and did a weekend seminar on TV comedy. What was important about Sherwood Oaks was that it was the first time that I knew of that professionals from the industry came into an environment where they served the community. That was the real and foremost gain of Sherwood Oaks. And I was part of that, and I started teaching screenwriting. I never had any idea about what it meant to teach screenwriting, or just teach, actually.
Yeah.
And I made an ass of myself the first 6 sessions. And then I said, well, look, this is not working, so what I'm going to do is learn from my students. So I walked in and I would listen to them, ask them what they wanted to know. Well, the questions were, you know, amazing, because they were like, what do you start with, character or structure, when you have an idea? Or how do you write a good action sequence? Or what's the difference between an action story and a love story? How do you create great characters? And I began to answer out of my own experience, not having any kind of formal education per se. But it was at that time when I'm not finishing Peck and Paw's story, but I'll go back. But I began to understand that everybody had the same questions to screenwriting. How do you begin? Do you have to have talent? Is it a craft? Can you understand this? And I remembered from my reading, and I remembered from those days at Cinemobile when I was looking at those movies, that it always opened with a sharp catching of the interest event. And then you have characters which are introduced, and then you have a particular incident that you've struggled, that the characters struggle through in order to resolve at the end of the story. So I used my own experience as a writer in terms of preparing my character, preparing the storyline, structuring the material, setting up everybody in Act One that you need to set up. And I began utilizing that and began teaching this particular screenplay class at Sherwood Oaks. And after a year or two, I had 300, 400 people in the class. It was an 8-week class, and each week I would focus on, well, setting up your screenplay, building great characters, writing the action sequence, the rewrite process, and people were coming in from all over. So when I had the urge then to go back to writing, because I had taken literally a 7-year hiatus from writing, I began looking at various projects I had, didn't want to rewrite them, but began to look at those old screenplays in terms of what I now knew, and started doing some new story ideas. And then I finally said, after about 8 months of not making anything but unemployment, well, maybe I should write out of my experience about what I'm doing right now, which is teaching a class at Sherwood Oaks. So I organized the material I was teaching and wrote a 65-page presentation, sent that off to an agent who I had met when I was working at Cinemobile, and she sold the book in 2 weeks. And it was a flyer for the Dell Publishing Company. They just, you know, well, here's a book on screenwriting, and it looks pretty interesting, and let's take a flyer. So I got commissioned to write this book called Screenplay. But part of that, and part of that recognizing what makes a screenplay different than any other form was what I learned a few years earlier from Sam Peckinpah. Because after I finished graduate school at UCLA, this is now a flashback we're going into. After I finished UCLA and went to work at Cinemobile, a friend of mine who I was acting with at Berkeley, with Renoir, came down, and Sam Peckinpah was her uncle. So she invited me out to the house, and Sam at that moment was writing The Wild Bunch. And he had not worked in 4 years. He had a reputation as a drunkard and a malcontent, and you can't work with him. But when I found him on that day, I talk about that in my book called Going to the Movies. Sam, at that moment in his life, was so insecure. He had been drinking terribly, and now he was on the wagon except for a beer, 2 beers a day. That's what he allowed himself. And I would go out to see Denine, his niece, who was staying with him. And we began talking about screenwriting and talking about research and talking about The Wild Bunch and talking about, you know, I asked him questions. How do you go about structuring your movies? And he said, well, you know, I start with an idea and then I find a point in the middle where something really happens. And then I spin that off. So he spins his characters into a storyline, peaks it at the middle, and then goes on to the end. And I thought about that, and I thought that was really interesting, how you begin to prepare an idea in terms of action and character. And he had finished the first draft of Wild Bunch, and I think I was one of the first ones to read it. He gave it to me. We had spent a long time together watching the sun go down, drinking beers, talking, and he asked me about Renoir and what it was like working with Renoir for a year, which I did as an actor. And when I read it, I was amazed because there was a definite flow, setting up the characters. There was an action event in the opening that grabbed everybody's attention. Then you began to go into the characters and establish who they are. And then there's a moment where something happens, where the story shifts into another direction. And then you begin to go on to the point where he was focusing on, which was the middle of the film. And in The Wild Bunch, it happened to be train robbery, which is one of the great sequences of modern film. That thing goes for about 12 minutes, and there's not a sound. There's no dialogue whatsoever. And it's done with surprise, and it's done with cleverness, and it's done with strong action. And I began to see how you set everything up toward that payoff in the middle, and then everything spins off that as an event. Ultimately leading to the end where, you know, his theme was unchanged men in a changing time. So unchanged men refusing to give up their ideals to deal with the modernness of contemporary life. Now, we're in that same situation today. You have a generation who doesn't know technology whatsoever, and we have a young generation that knows everything about technology, or so far. But we're the only generation where we create the technology and the children teach us how to use it. And that's exactly unchanged men in a changing time. So Sam was writing about that at the turn of the century, about the West and about how industrialization, civilization was going and moving forward. And he gave me a copy of a script called Major Dundee to read. And that for me was my real learning lesson before I hit The Wild Bunch. Because he had done Major Dundee. After that movie, the studio changed it on him. He was considered unworkable, not to be hired at all. So he went into his own depression at that point. But Major Dundee taught me so much about screenwriting in terms of setting up your characters, in terms of setting up your story visually, in terms of the action that's going on, and in terms of how you utilize a strong action with character by creating a humorous situation after the strong violence situation. That, of course, was done in Shakespeare with Macbeth on the knocking at the gate, you know, after the murder of Duncan. And then you cut to the drunk at the gate, you know, who is letting in Macduff.
Yeah, one of the most horrific pieces of theater, right next to one of the most comedic.
Exactly, juxtaposed to something comedic. And that's how Sam did his screenplays. I mean, just in that way. So I began using these examples as I was teaching at Sherwood Oaks to these people who wanted to be screenwriters and everything. And after 2 years, as mentioned, that's when I decided I was going to go back to writing, and I started writing the presentation for the book. The book got sold, and I remember meeting the president of the Bantam Doubleday Dell Publishing Company. He was drunk at a party. They invited me as an afterthought because I was in L.A. and the convention was in L.A. And I was surrounded by a group of executives. They couldn't understand why this book had gone through 3 printings in 5 months. They just couldn't understand it because it took me a year and a half to write the book, and I was just writing what I had learned from my students at Sherwood Oaks Experimental College. And they had no idea what made this thing so popular. And I told them, you don't know what's going on. You may think there's not an audience here, but there's a tremendous audience here, and you just have to learn how to utilize it.
And the book then went on to dramatically affect the industry, and all the executives started reading it and then
exactly.
utilizing it. And did you have any idea it would have that dramatic an effect on the industry?
No. Nobody told me anything, really. I'm the last person to know anything because everyone expects me to know something, and I don't. But I remember when James L. Brooks and Mary Kay Place were down at this little park where a lot of us used to gather and play touch football and run and jog and so on. And Mary Kay Place told me that not to worry that my book was being read. That was the first thing that anybody had ever said to me. And I thought that was just wonderful, but I didn't know what that meant. And then when everybody started reading it and quoting from it, I was, of course, the object of, well, who was he to say that? But anyway, basically, when I was creating screenplay, I did not know what I was doing. I mean, someone asked me what a screenplay was, and about 2 weeks later, I came up with the answer, and the answer was the paradigm. And over the years, it's amazing because I see how effective and how absolutely right on the paradigm is. Because whether you're writing a linear movie, whether you're writing a non-linear movie, whether you're writing about this lifetime or 3 different lifetimes or 4 different stories like Babel, the paradigm works. I mean, I don't care in Babel, the film is structured so well that it just flows together from one sequence, one character, into another. So, of course, you have a plot point, a turning point at the end of Act 1, which is the shooting. You have plot point 2, where they're rescued with a helicopter, and then you pay off all the other stories. So I'm learning that over the years in the many seminars I've given around the world, people tell me how valuable that is. And I begin to see now, really after some 20-odd years, how accurate the paradigm really is. Because if you are writing a sequence, you've got to have a beginning, middle, and end to that sequence. If you want to write an act or a screenplay or a non-linear screenplay, there's always a beginning and there's always a middle and there's always an end, but not necessarily in that order, as Jean-Luc Godard says.
It's really interesting hearing you talk because you're known as a guru and as a teacher of the paradigm, the screenwriting model, but you constantly talk about learning all of this from your students.
Oh, yeah. My students taught me everything. I mean, it was their questions that allowed me to go into my experience and formulate an answer that they could understand and that worked effectively. And I'm still learning this. You know, the new material for the 2-day seminar I'm doing, the Foundations of Screenwriting, takes in a lot of this new material that I've written about in the new revised screenplay that's not even in the original screenplay. But I never knew how universal the paradigm really is. That's really the truth. People use it for everything, for TV, for novels. I remember doing a seminar in the mountains in Norway. There were many novelists and screenwriters and playwriters there. We had about 23 people of all different medias. And after the 4 days was over, because we spent 4 days there together just working on an interactive basis, a writer came up to me and he said, a novelist, and he said, you know, I've been stuck on this novel for a year and a half. And listening to the paradigm, I see now how to make this work. So I thanked him, and he thanked me, and we went our ways. And about 2 years later, I got a note from him, a letter, saying that he had finished the novel, and he wanted to thank me because the novel was now the number two bestseller in Norway and in all of the Scandinavian countries. So it was, you organize your story because, you know, you've got to have a foundation. And if you just sit down and start writing a screenplay, which I've done, you know, fade in, exterior, desert, day, you know, a cloud of dust hovers over the horizon. And if you don't know where you're going, you've had it. There ain't no way you're going to get out of there. And that's the art of screenwriting. It's the craft, the art and the craft. You can feel your way through a novel. You can feel your way through a play to the end. But you cannot feel your way through a screenplay. You've got to have some direction, which means a line of development unfolding.
Because it's such a definitely structured art form, isn't it? You know, you have these 2 hours in which an audience can experience this story. So there have to be these...
You've got to keep the audience. Yeah. I mean, you've got to keep the audience on the edge of their seat. I mean, Jim Cameron... I interviewed Jim. I think I was the only one who got to interview him because he had read screenplay. And he said, when I read screenplay, I knew that I could do this. And he sat down and he wrote Piranha 2, which was his first directorial thing. And then he got fired from it. And then he ended up writing Terminator. But Jim told me that he understood that once he read the book, he could figure out in reverse engineering how to work a screenplay. So that was very flattering for me. That's in my book, Four Screenplays. I have an interview with him that's extraordinary.
Talking about Four Screenplays, you also analyze Kalikuri's Thelma and Louise.
Yes.
And there's a great quote from her that I discovered in a book of interviews with American screenwriters. And she talks about how she had this idea for the story and actually sitting down to write this screenplay, the difficulty of it. And I'll quote what she said, I started to really figure out how to tell a story in pictures. I picked up the Sid Field book and looked through it, and I thought, this is just way too structured. I could never write like that. I'm just going to tell this story. I know what makes a good movie. I know what I want to see. And you would think she would absolutely have written a film to which your paradigm could not be applied. And then you come along later and...
My favorite teaching film.
Absolutely.
To this day.
It's in your book, Full Screenplays, yes. And it matches the paradigm almost exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you see, and what's interesting, I get accused a lot of being formulaic, meaning that writing a screenplay by a formula. And I counter that by saying that we're talking about form and not formula. I mean, a formula means that you take the same things in any form, you mix it together, you pour together, and the results are constantly the same. Well, that's a contradiction. You can't have a comedy in an action film. You can't have a character piece like The Hours in a classic noir film or a romance like Casablanca. You just can't do it. So a form is simply a form. You have a suitcase. Suitcases vary in size, in content, in structure, in... materiel, they all are different, but the concept of a space inside three sides with a zippered cover works appropriately. That's what the paradigm is. It's just a model. So you can use anything with that.
You often get accused of being, I suppose, the king of formula, and when people talk about Hollywood formulaic screenplays, your name usually follows quite soon after that. But when you talk about Renoir a lot, you know, your experiences with him. You talk about European films. Some of the films you use in, not only you write about, but in your seminar as well, are films people, I think, would not expect you to be championing.
Exactly.
and analysing. Magnolia is
oh,
one.
Oh, God. I love that.
Annie Hall, Royal Tenenbaums, The Hours, you just mentioned as well.
I love it because they all fit. I mean, my favorite is when people stand up and boo and say, you're too formulaic, this doesn't work. I say, well, let's take a journey through Pulp Fiction. And that quiets everybody. And I go through and I show how Pulp Fiction, there are three stories within one story. And each story, if you take it apart, has a beginning, middle, and end. Even if it ends, even if it begins in the middle, it doesn't matter. So we go through Pulp Fiction that way. And they begin to understand that if you do a nonlinear film, say English Patient, where you have two stories, time past and time present, the time present has to be structured from beginning to end. Time past has to be structured from beginning to end. Then you can intersect those at any place you want. And that's how the whole thing works. I mean, the more I learn about the paradigm, and I'm constantly learning about it, that's what I see. And when I started out, it's interesting, when I started teaching, people did not believe in dramatic structure for the screenplay. They said, show me. So I would say, well, look, on page 25 to 27, there's this event that happens in Act 1. And then on page 85 to 90, there's another event that happens. And I was so specific that I literally had to force them to look at certain times in a film in order to determine what the structure was. Now, of course, I mean, for the last 15, 20 years, I haven't had to do that. I don't even mention numbers at all. I just say it happens about this period of time. In Thelma and Louise, you know, the plot point at the end of Act 1 is like 18, 19 minutes in the film. But so what? My motto is, does it work? If it works, use it.
It's interesting talking about non-linear film. You've said recently that you think there's a screenwriting revolution happening, and that is somehow connected to non-linear film and new ways of telling stories.
Yes. You know, we talked earlier about Sam Peckinpah and his theme of unchanged men in a changing time. We're in a changing time right now. It's a time of technology. So with technology comes the distinction, and screenwriting is all about distinction, between the analog method of thinking and the digital method of thinking. Meaning that in analog, you had separate tracks. You had soundtracks, picture tracks, whatever. And it read each track differently in analog. Now we're in the age of digital. And in digital, all bits are the same, meaning that sound can be read as music, can be read as picture, with no distinction whatsoever. Now, the job of the artist is to capture the internal state of their character. We find that in painting all the time. They start out with landscape scenes, then they go into impressionism, then they go into cubism and abstract expressionism. We're trying to get closer to the human experience, the human emotion. Well, that to me is happening in film right now, and it's due to the impact that technology is having on film. Film is a combination of art and science. So when the art expands, like in Terminator 2 that Jim Cameron did, when art expands, science has to come up to meet the demand of the artist. And sometimes, like in digital, the art has to come up to meet the science. That's what film is, art and science. So I think that we're entering an era where we are utilizing the thinking of our attention spans into a progression of visual images. So one of the examples I have for the foundation seminar that I'm going to do this weekend is that in the movie Casablanca, you had a present time story and you had the past love affair between Rick and Ilsa. And if you watch that film, the present time is unfolding until Rick and Ilsa get together and they talk about Paris. Then suddenly there's a flashback that shows us what happened in Paris. And it was simply inserted into the narrative line, just dropped in. And then it went on its way, and then we get back to the present time, and then there's another flashback. But it's inserted.
With a dissolve.
With a dissolve to make sure that we knew where we were. Now you get a film like the Bourne Supremacy, number 2, which I heard they were just shooting the Bourne Ultimatum right outside the building not too long ago. But in the Bourne Supremacy, what you have are flashbacks. You have memories. You have fragments of memories. You have bits and pieces of thoughts coming in to the narrative line. So that to me is a reflection of the technology that we're into, MTV basically. Our attention spans become so short that you have a film where you can insert a flashback, a moment, and you understand what's going on because our audiences are so sophisticated now. In the 40s with Casablanca, they weren't. Now we're a very sophisticated international audience. And you can throw in time past, time present, doesn't matter. It's like the opening of The Lookout, which I like very much. The Scott Frank film, I'm sure it's opened here. Scott Frank is the screenwriter of Get Shorty and one of my favorite films, which I can't think of right now, with Jennifer Lopez and George Clooney.
Out of Sight.
Yes, Out of Sight.
I love that.
Yeah, he's just a great writer, and he wrote this film called Lookout. And Lookout's the story of a young kid, a natural athlete, champion athlete, who was injured in a car crash due to his own negligence and is mentally affected by the accident. He cannot sequence. So the film begins with him waking up in the morning. Talk about structure. There's a beginning. He wakes up in the morning, and the voiceover is, I wake up. I turn off the alarm clock. I take a shower. I eat breakfast with toast. Then you hear the scratching of an eraser. I wake up, and you see the same action over and over again. He has trouble sequencing. It's an amazing insight into the life of who this character is, done in three or four different shots in three or four different ways with a voiceover. That's technology. That's the way we listen to this podcast we're doing right now. We enter into the mind and we enter into the consciousness of the viewer by entering the character's mind state, so we know who he is or where she's going or whatever. It doesn't matter. But that's the revolution that's going on right now, is that we're learning how to tell pictures in a different way. Because, you know, it's not important what happens, but what we're seeing, how it happens, is different. Stories are the same. We just now get to incorporate more internal visualization into the action.
So your paradigm actually fits a whole host of non-linear films.
For sure.
Although you, I think you were critical of one incredibly non-linear film, and that was
21 Grams.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you see, here's the distinction between 21 Grams and Babel. 21 Grams, the film is based on one event, one incident, the accident. And it takes you through three or four different stories, and they're arbitrarily chosen at different points in the story for us to put it together like a jigsaw puzzle after. But there was no guidance of emotionality through that film. It was like an arbitrary putting in this sequence and this sequence and this sequence and this sequence. However, you get to Babel, that's a totally different story. You have one event, that is the shooting of the Cate Blanchett character, and you have it told in four different points of view, but you have a narrative line that is a visually continuation of a structure. So the film opens with the nanny and the kids, and then it goes into the mountains in Morocco, and you have the rifle being given, and then shots, you know something's going to happen. And then, of course, then we meet the American couple, and then she's shot on the bus. You know that there's going to be an interaction. And everything glides us through toward the very end, where we realize that the Japanese person is the one who gave the rifle to the guide in Morocco anyway. So the whole thing is the same kind of a structure, but one has an organic framework to it, tied together with this visual action of the rifle, whereas 21 Grams tries to do that but doesn't succeed, in my opinion. But the guy's a great filmmaker. I mean, he just really is exploring new ways of telling stories. I think that's so important.
Nice to hear some of your views on British films at the moment. We're very kind of self-critical of our own movie industry, what little of it we have. But it would be nice to hear what you think about British films that have kind of come to your radar.
I really think now of the international film. I haven't seen many British films, so to speak. But look at the talent you have here. You have the greatest actors in the world. You've got the greatest writers, playwrights in the world. You've got great directors here. Paul Greengrass is just... who did The Bourne Supremacy, is just an extraordinary director in United 93. Extraordinary. You have the most amazing talent here, but why there are no great screenplays is a mystery to me. Because you come out of such a tradition of theater. I was just looking at something, the John Osborne Center. I mean, the guy revolutionized playwriting. So I don't know why that is. I don't know whether it's the people who are selecting the material, I don't know whether it's the people who do something like Love Actually or Four Weddings and a Funeral, where it's just not much of anything. It's like cotton candy, you know? It looks good, but there ain't nothing there. So that's my experience only, and it's so limited, I cannot make a generalization. So all you people who are listening to this, please forgive me for making this astounding generalization, because I don't know whether it's true or not.
I think one of the problems is that there's still this belief here that screenwriting can't be taught, and structure is inimical to creativity, and all of those things. And it's a debate we have on Screenwriters Bulletin every month.
Really?
It blows up again. Just when you think you've done it, suddenly someone will talk about a course, and then someone will come in and say, who are these people teaching us how to write? You can't do it. You can't teach creativity. And then everyone pitches in.
Well, they're right. I mean, you cannot teach creativity, but you can certainly teach the craft. I mean, the craft is something you can be learned, and then you have to modify it to meet your own needs and your own wants. I hear this all the time, you know, and if you look at the universe had a beginning, right? We're in the middle right now. And who knows, 50 million years from now, the sun's going to dim and the universe is going to reach its outermost point and then begin to collapse in on itself. There's always a beginning, middle, end. I don't know what the problem is. People want to say, well, there's no way you can teach creativity. That's absolutely correct. But you can teach the craft. Talent is God's gift to someone. You either have it or you don't. But just because you don't have it doesn't mean you can't be a superb craftsman. Creativity is creativity. Now, whether it's writing a screenplay or painting a picture or playing the piano, you can have a great musician who are ordinary talent, and you can have an ordinary talent who plays great music. I mean, you look at Bob Dylan as a musician, he's not much of anything. He's a great technician, definitely, and his poetry is extraordinary, and I love his music, but you can't say that he's a great musical talent. He's a great songwriter. He's a great performer. But if you look at his voice in relationship to other voices out there, he ain't much of anything.
But at some point, he had to learn how to play chords.
That's right. He used to practice, you know, in that documentary that Marty Scorsese did. He practiced for years, and he would always go picking up from other musicians how to play and everything. So the question of, well, if you know, creativity can't be taught, that's bullshit. That's a way of avoiding your own responsibility to yourself. And it brings to mind a story. Here's my experience of many foreign screenwriters, no, in America too, Universal. I was in Poland giving a talk to about 200 students at the Polish Film School. And I asked, how many of you want to write? And most of the room raised their hand. I said, that's really cool. How many of you have written two or more screenplays? Not one person raised their hand. How many of you have written one screenplay? Three people raised their hand. And I said, well, you say you want to be writers, but why aren't you writing? Well, nobody's paying me.
Oh.
So, I mean, if a writer, you know, a writer writes, a director directs, and an actor acts. If you don't take the time to hone and practice your own skills, it ain't there. You've got to sit down and spend time learning your craft. And believe me, it is a craft that occasionally rises to the level of art, as Bill Goldman says. You got a story to tell, you tell the story. And if a class can help you learn some of the things, I have people coming in who are aspiring screenwriters, who are professional screenwriters who have written three or four or five screenplays, have had films produced, but they've reached a point in their career where they don't know what to do or how to do it. And they come to the workshop just listening. And suddenly there's an idea there that sparks them. And they go and they find a new way to explore the craft of screenwriting. Happens all the time. I'll never forget that in Poland. I was so shocked that they want to be writers, but no one's paying them. It sounds like Hollywood. You know? Nobody's paying me to write this. But what's worse in Hollywood right now, imagine that you're a successful screenwriter. Here's your life in Hollywood. You have an idea for a great movie. You go into people who will take a meeting with you in 5 minutes, And then they say, well, this is very interesting, but we'd like to put that on the back burner, and we have something that we'd like you to work on. And they bring out this old project that they want the screenwriter to work on. And so what happens, they say, okay, a case in point is X-Men 1, 2, and 3. They were so nervous about this movie that what they did was they hired one writer to write a first draft. Then they brought in another writer to rewrite and another writer to rewrite that. And they were working simultaneously. And they found out about it. So they decided to work together on X-Men 3, Simon Kinberg and Zach Penn. They decided to work together to create the third draft. Because the normal thing in Hollywood is that you'll never get to do an original screenplay. Everybody wants you to do their material. So with Simon, what they did was they had him write a draft, they have someone else write a draft like Zach Penn, and then usually they'll hire another writer, a third writer. The third writer will come in and cobble together a Frankenstein draft, incorporating the best of the first, the best of the second, and the best of the third. That's Hollywood, that's life in Hollywood right now. It's amazing. That's why it's so important to know the craft, to know the structure, because if, for example, you do get fortunate enough to sell your screenplay and have it produced, structure will allow you to change an indoor scene to an outdoor scene. And if it's rain, if you've written it for rain and it's sunny out, you can still shoot it in the sun and you have your structure intact.
Do you still read a lot of screenplays by first-time
yes.
writers? What are the most common mistakes that you see?
Oh, that's a big question. Here's the most common mistake. People tell their story in dialogue. So that's contradictory to the nature of a screenplay. What is the nature of a screenplay? It's a story told with pictures. Hello, we're watching something on the screen here. You're not telling a story with words. So the dialogue serves only to move the story forward or reveal information on the character. That's all. That's the most common mistake. Or people want to avoid having a structurally, they think they know their structure. So what they do is they become very subtle in their storyline. So subtle, you don't even know what's going on. They're afraid to come right out. Well, in some scenes in a screenplay, you have to be direct. You've got to hit the nail dead on because your story has to move forward. And if we don't know what's going on, who does?
You've recently started your own podcast, haven't you? Which is unusual. That's a video podcast.
Video podcast.
Just audio. You've done two so far.
We've two which are out. We've really done five.
Okay.
And we've cut the two. One of Michael Arndt, who did Little Miss Sunshine, which I'm going to be using in our seminar over the weekend. And we have Stuart Beatty, who did Collateral and Pirates of the Caribbean. We did Simon Kinberg, who did X-Men 3 and Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which I like very much. And we did Rick Linkletter and Eric Schlosser, who did Fast Food Nation, which was very, very interesting. Of course, the film came out and just sank because they didn't know how to sell it at all. And then we did Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden, who did Half Nelson. But we haven't cut the last two because we're in a holding pattern to see what we're going to do with it now. So we've got these five episodes. Two are done, and three are getting ready to be done, are in post-production. But it's a series called Screenplay, and you can access at least one free downloaded of six episodes with Michael Arndt of Little Miss Sunshine. And the web address is www.screenplay-series.com.
And you also have your own website.
I have my
as
own
well.
Website, sidfield.com. And we have interviews with writers. We have various things on the website that are interesting. And now I'm working with screenwriters. I'm co-writing a screenplay with an Indian writer-director who did a film called Rang de Basanti that was nominated last year for the BAFTAs. And there's a real interesting phenomenon happening in India right now where you have the Bollywood films that will never change, the 3-4 hour movies, you know, with songs and dances and so on. But you also have a new wave of young filmmakers coming out of India that want to tell contemporary stories, whether it be about their past or whether it be about contemporary situations. So I'm working in that capacity with a production company there and these filmmakers there, which I love. I think it's a whole new thing. And then I'm getting ready to do a new DVD for Final Draft called The Master Class. And we're going to be starting to prepare that in the summer. And hopefully we'll be out sometime in the fall.
And will that be going through the paradigm?
That will be going the paradigm you can't get away from. It's like the sun. I mean, do you want to do something without the sun? I mean, not. I don't want to be egotistical here at all, but you know, it's a foundation. So everything includes the paradigm. I don't care whether you want to rewrite your material. How do you approach a rewrite? That's one of the subjects we have over the weekend. How do you approach a rewrite? I mean, you have to approach it as units of action. Well, what are the units? Beginning, middle, and end. Okay, so let's work in the beginning. Now, how you articulate that and execute that, that's up to you. So the paradigm is just a model, and if you understand the dynamics, that everything has a form, and it's up to you to find and release that form, then you're in great shape. I mean, look at Michelangelo. You know, people say, well, how did you, you know, sculpt all those magnificent things? He would say, I would look at the piece of granite until the form revealed itself to me. That's exactly what happens. You may not believe this, people, but it's really true. Just let yourself go.
Thank you ever so much for taking time out of your stay here in London to talk to the Shooting People Screenwriters Network. It's been great talking to you. I'm really looking forward to the seminar this weekend as well.
Great. Well, I'm very happy to be here. I mean, you guys, start a revolution. Somebody!
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, Andy.
So that's the end of another Shooting Screenwriters podcast. A big thank you to Sid Field and to Liz and Rinaldo from the Screenwriter Store for arranging everything. And as always, to shooter Dan Swire for his tech support. Remember, if you're not a Shooting People member, you can join at www.shootingpeople.org. If you are a member and you want to talk about this podcast, then drop me an email at the Screenwriters Network Bulletin. Until next time, thank you for listening.